So in this one, I'll be talking about Israel, Palestine, Hamas, and how the narrative is controlled on both sides, and how this dilemma is part of a major dialectic problem that leads to problems beyond Israel and Palestine in particular. I'll be talking a little bit about the Qatari royal family known as the Al Thani, and I'll be talking about Israel's bioconvergence agenda, which is no different than the biodigital convergence in Canada, which I've covered in a few different videos. So here is Sir Albert Pike. He's a Freemason, founder of the KKK, and a Confederate general. He also famously wrote a book called Morals and Dogma of Freemasonry, which is kind of like a for dummies book on Freemasonry. And so the key quotes to take from this is a third world war will occur between the political Zionists and the leaders of the Islamic world. This war must be conducted in such a way that Islam and political Zionism mutually destroy each other. And meanwhile, the other nations, once more divided on this issue, will be constrained to fight to the point of complete physical, moral, spiritual, and economical exhaustion. It's interesting how this comes from a quote-unquote civil war general talking about the third world war, if you will. So, anyway, moving forward here, talking about the Palestinian side of things here, we have these two brother and sister here that have an organization called Pali Roots. And so these two are Amina and Hussein Musa. And Amina graduated from the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising as a fashion product development major. And Hussein worked as a brand developer who built up an agency for $1 million plus brands, specializing in web development, marketing, and design. So we can see who handles each half within Pali Roots. And so it says here, Meal Program is our hallmark charity operation that was grown beyond our imagination. It started with the mere idea that the work we are doing to spread the Palestinian culture around the world must be sustained with Palestine. What better way to ensure that than directly support the growth of Palestinian children who will carry that responsibility? In addition, the program supports their families by providing monthly food parcels, compensation for food hospital visits, and provides working opportunities to marginalized women. We partnered with Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, to carry out the ground operation and to ensure every meal is allocated to a child in Palestine. Okay, it sounds great at face value, and so you can see these are the other organizations here in which are recommended and apparently vetted by Pali Roots, although ties to the UN. I've not dived into every organization here other than Mecca, but I think UN Refugees says enough in its title right there. And you can see too that, so a lot of people, as I was talking about how this Israel-Palestine problem is also affecting other countries as they don't know what side to take or are taking certain sides, etc., and keeping the people divided, is you have Pali Roots basically supporting a lot of causes like BLM, Indigenous Hawaiians, and so on and so forth, and helping the Uyghur Muslims. And so some of these things are directly Marxist, like BLM. Although the Uyghur Muslims in China, in particular, oppressed by the CCP, is, a very real, profound, and prolific issue. However, what I'm saying is that the quote-unquote left wing of the bird, left and right wing, being part of the same bird, the left side of the bird finds parties or groups that appear to be victimized in some way, whether that be the reality or that be something being blown out of proportion. And they hop on things like this and almost make a lot of victim-driven type of causes and keep people in a state of victimhood rather than empowering them, they disempower them. So take away the warrior spirit from people. And so here is MECA, Middle East Children's Alliance. This is who Pally Roots partner with. They work to protect the rights and improve the lives of children in the Middle East through the aid, empowerment, and education. And in the Middle East, MECA provides humanitarian aid, partners with community organizations to run projects for children, and supports income generation projects. In the U.S. and internationally, MECA raises awareness about the lives of children in the region and encourages meaningful action, if you say so. So once again, you know, mentioning that Pally Roots and MECA are in partnership. So this is basically a GoFundMe. And so I saw different friends of mine actually on social media supporting Pally Roots. And so I thought I'd decide to give this a further look because, like I say, the narrative is controlled on both sides. And you can even take a look at the funding for MECA, which is definitely questionable. It says here that donors include the Rockefeller Brothers Fund and Open Society Foundation. So Open Society is ran by George Soros and his son Alex Soros. So I think that here says enough. You've got about $430,000 between 2016 and 2023 from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. And then between 2020 and 2022, $400,000 from George Soros Open Society Foundation. So with this here, here is some of the grants that they have received. So peace building. And so these are some of the grants received through the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. So for 9 months from March 30th, $75,000, $150,000 for 24 months for this RAWA, Creative Palestinian Communities Fund. So, excuse me. So it's kind of interesting to see that the Rockefeller family, essentially their organization, and then George Soros also support Palestine. So, I mean, when you take into effect Soros' history that they'll teach you anyway, is that he has every reason for opposing Zionist Israel. However, fact of the matter is that in George Soros' supervillain origin story, for lack of better words, he went along with the National Socialists and profited from taking property and assets from people that were rounded up by the National Socialists, in particular the Jewish people. So here is Stephen B. Hines. He is the president and CEO of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, a family foundation with an endowment of approximately $1.2 billion that advances social change for a more just, sustainable, and peaceful world. This guy coined the term acupuncture philanthropy to describe the philanthropic approach of leveraging modest financial assets to trigger larger systemic change on critical issues. In 2010, he set an ambitious path to align investment of the fund's financial assets with its mission, resulting in its 2014 decision to divest from fossil fuels and establishing the RBF as a leader in the divest invest movement. Okay. And so he's also a fellow at the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and of the China Council for International Cooperation on Environment and Development. He serves on the boards of the Quincy Institute, David Rockefeller Fund, and the Rockefeller Archive Center. He is the recipient of the Council on Foundations 2018 Distinguished Service Award. Okay, so moving forward, I'm not really going to read too much about Open Society Foundations or anything at all, really, because I think people already probably know what that is, and I've probably mentioned Soros enough in the course of my videos. But the difference between myself and, say, the controlled opposition freedom movement is that they focus on certain people like George Soros, where you're pretty much tunnel visioned looking at people like that and not looking at the other side of the bird. So if Soros is part of the left wing side of the bird, then the right wing side of the bird would be like the Koch family and stuff like that. So this was a 2-year term of sorts where $400,000 was given to MECCA, the Middle East Children's Alliance, by Open Society Foundations. So now I'm going to read a little bit about something called B'nai B'rith. And so it's a staunch defender in the State of Israel. So once again now, so the regime and the rebellion, however you really want to categorize it, are funded by the same people. And so it's majority of what I would term the regime that tends to openly support Israel and Zionism, whereas the quote-unquote rebellion, if you will, tend to support the, we'll say, what appear to be like a victimized class, if you will. And again, this kind of terminology that I'm using, or outlooks, can differ depending on where you are, and there is all kinds of propaganda spit up on both sides anyway. So people have a hard time comprehending that it's not only problems that are created by these dark forces, but they create an artificial solution and hide behind various fronts. And these fronts include the rebellion and the regime, so to speak, right? So B'nai B'rith is a staunch defender of the State of Israel, advocates for global Jewry, and champions the cause of human rights. B'nai B'rith is recognized as a vital voice in combating anti-Semitism, promoting Jewish unity and continuity, a leader in disaster relief and assisting communities in crisis, a provider of safe and affordable housing of low-income older adults, and a tireless advocate on behalf of seniors, if you say so. And since our founding in 1843, B'nai B'rith has focused on making the world a safer and more tolerant place with a presence in countries around the world. B'nai B'rith is the global voice of the Jewish community. Well, if you look at this picture here on the right, that very much just looks no different than Masonic fraternity. But that's exactly what B'nai B'rith is. That is exactly what it started out as. And so it was founded in this particular gentleman's cafe in New York City's Lower East Side on October 13th. 1843, by 12 recent German Jewish immigrants led by Henry Jones. It was organized as a secret lodge. There you go. Masons have a lodge, just like those who train in the Japanese martial arts have a dojo. The new organization represented an attempt to organize Jews of the local community to confront what Isaac Rosenberg, one of the founders, called the deplorable condition of Jews in this, our newly developed country. The new group's purpose, as described in its constitution, called for the traditional functions performed by Jewish societies in Europe, visiting and attending the sick, and protecting and assisting the widow and the orphan. Its founders had hoped that it soon would encompass all Jews in the U.S., but this did not happen, since other Jewish organizations also were forming around the same time. German-speaking founders originally named the organization Bundesbrüder. I'm sorry about the pronunciation, I don't speak German. That means Brothers of the Covenant. And to reflect the goal of a fraternal order that would provide comfort to the entire spectrum of Jewish Americans, and also Masons refer to each other as brother. So, although early meetings were conducted in German, after a short time English emerged as the language of choice and the name was changed to B'nai B'rith in the late 20th century, the translation was changed to the more contemporary and inclusive Children of the Covenant. This is exactly what B'nai B'rith means. So, here you have this particular gentleman who is the CEO of B'nai B'rith, Daniel Mariashin. I apologize again for the pronunciation. So, he is the CEO and supervises B'nai B'rith's programs. And basically in the U.S. and abroad, he's met with many scores of heads of state, prime ministers, foreign ministers, opposition leaders, religious leaders, and influential members of the media to advance human rights and to help protect rights of Jewish communities worldwide, as to promote better relations with the state of Israel. And he's also served at B'nai B'rith's International Center for Human Rights and Public Policy, and in the position he is a spokesperson for B'nai B'rith, interpreting its policies to a variety of audiences, including U.S. Congress, world leaders, global diplomats, and the media, with responsibility for coordinating the organization's programs and policies on issues of concern to the Jewish community. And also in 1977, let me scroll down to that. In 1977 in particular, he joined the Anti-Defamation League, and otherwise known as ADL. And so he joined ADL as the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith as director of its Middle East Affairs Department. And from 79-86, he served as ADL's national director, the late Nathan Perlmutter, and as director of its national leadership division, responsible for ADL's nationwide program of leadership development. Okay. So, and he's been featured in all, you know, kinds of magazines, Chicago Tribune, New York Times, Jerusalem Post, Times of Israel, etc. And so we can see the relationship that they have with the United Nations, of course. Since the founding conference of the United Nations in San Francisco in 1945, B'nai B'rith has led Jewish communal engagement with the world body. We maintain full-time on-the-ground representation at UN agencies around the world. So, of course, they're aligned with the United Nations. And, of course, everybody follows the United Nations Sustainable Development Agenda as part of their mandates. All of the Sustainable Development Agenda, UNDRIP, Paris Agreement, and other tyrannical measures are things that all kind of lead toward what Canada's Policy Horizons calls biodigital convergence and what Israel Innovation calls bioconvergence. Use different terms to mean the same thing, but it's an amalgamation and synthesis of AI and biological life, which is quite twisted and really some kind of mad scientist experiment, if you ask me. So, with this here, ADL speaks out when anti-Israel rhetoric or activism engages in distortions or delegitimizes Israel, crosses into anti-Semitism when it demonizes or negates Zionism and uses anti-Jewish assertions and tropes. So this statement right here is pure social engineering, and same with this one here, and I will break it down and destroy this brainwashing here. Within Israel, ADL addresses issues of racism, discrimination, and hate, and promotes social cohesion initiatives across Israel's diverse communities while educating the Israeli public about the dangers of rising anti-Semitism. We educate and engage on how harsh expressions of the Jewish state and Zionism can be anti-Semitic. That statement is bold and wrong, of course. And so, Martin Luther King, on a side note, whose campaign was funded by the Rothschilds, whose father was a Prince Hall Mason, and whose wife was part of the Eastern Star, he gave his final presentation in a Masonic lodge. But the big point that I'm getting at in regards to those statements about Zionism and anti-Semitism, Martin Luther King was gatekeeping in the same way that Anti-Defamation League and B'nai B'rith does. When people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You're talking anti-Semitism. Couldn't be further from the truth, buddy. So, to break this down, the term anti-Semitism, meaning anti-Jewish, basically, doesn't actually make sense, because Semitic peoples are people that speak a certain set of languages, including Arabic, Aramaic, and Hebrew. Jewish is not a language. So anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, two different things. Also, for somebody to say that anti-Zionism is the same thing as anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish, that also couldn't be further from the truth. Zionism means you believe in the formation of a Jewish state or country. Therefore, you do not have to be Jewish to be a Zionist. So, there you have it. And so, also, too, with just with the history of Israel in and of itself, that spot has had many evictions and also forced immigrations of Jewish people over time. And so, not all Jewish people support the idea of a Jewish state or country. And like I said, a Zionist, to be a Zionist, you do not have to be Jewish, as they're two different things. So, in World War II, what happened was Hitler ended up striking this deal called the Havara Agreement, and he struck this with Zionists. Again, not Jewish people, he struck this deal with Zionists, and he was basically luring Jewish people into Israel and offering them incentives to go there. And so Israel, which wasn't called Israel until 1948, but Israel and Palestine, that whole region essentially, was filled with Jewish people that were brought there. And there were German goods and stuff like that to bolster the economy for Germany. And what ended up happening was over time, Jews were gradually forced out instead of lured and incentivized to go there. And then eventually you have people being scrutinized and different forms of propaganda up until they're brought into what they call concentration camps. So, we also have to bear in mind, too, that more than Jewish people were persecuted and put into those camps. So, anyway, Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO and National Director of ADL. He's the 6th National Director, and as Chief Executive of ADL, Jonathan leads all aspects of the world's anti-hate organization. He's an accomplished entrepreneur and innovative leader with deep experience in the private, public, and nonprofit sectors. And since becoming CEO in July 2015, Greenblatt has modernized ADL while refocusing it on the mission it has had since its founding in 1913, to fight the defamation of Jewish people and to secure justice and fair treatment to all, if you say so. And basically, under Greenblatt, ADL has modernized its operations, innovated its approaches to counter anti-Semitism from all sides, and enhanced its efforts to combat extremism in all forms. And during his tenure, ADL rebooted its Center on Extremism that analyzes and monitors extremists and hate groups, launched Never Is Now, the largest annual convening in the world, focused on anti-Semitism and hate, created the Center for Technology and Society in Silicon Valley to fight the rising tide of online hate and harassment, partnered with Aspen Institute to launch a civil society fellowship, an innovative program that builds cohorts of emerging leaders across a continuum of ideology and identity, developed by the Sports Leadership Council to engage athletes, teams, and leagues to confront bigotry and discrimination more effectively, and executed Stop Hate for Profit, a successful campaign that organized business, celebrities, nonprofits, and policymakers to fight the rampant racism, anti-Semitism, and extremism on Facebook. Basically, you're being a fact checker is exactly what you're doing. And of course, partnering with Silicon Valley, no surprise, because you have a lot of people working on the quote-unquote left side of the bird, if you will, in Silicon Valley. So, and then you have Ben Sachs, who heads the chair of the board of directors, and essentially he has a background in financial, estate, and tax planning to asset allocation and investment. So that's the head of the chair of ADL. And then you have here, now I'm going to be talking about Hamas a little bit and Palestine and that kind of a thing. So here is basically, it says, even more sinister is the way that Israeli authorities have to this day continue to deliberately enable Hamas, right? After Hamas's recent attack on Israel, Netanyahu vowed that every member of the group is a quote-unquote dead man, yet Netanyahu has also strategically facilitated millions in funding to Hamas by allowing Qatar to give cash subsidies to Gaza, cash he knew would flow undetectable to Hamas leadership. And we're going to be talking about Qatar and the Qatari royal family known as the Al Thani and how they actually play into this whole thing. And also with Hamas quite directly. So, since 2009, Netanyahu's political strategy has revolved around keeping Hamas alive and kicking, even if it hurts his own people, while Israel and Netanyahu give lip service on the international stage to seeking a two-state solution. Hamas provides a convenient excuse to avoid pursuing one. This reality is neither a conspiracy theory, nor is it particularly well hidden. I hate that term, by the way. In fact, Netanyahu has several Israeli officials have spoken of it openly. Yes, which is very true. Hamas is directly funded by Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel. And so it's essentially an excuse to keep a conflict ongoing. This shows, you know, if Hamas is supposed to oppose Israel, then why is it literally funded by them? So, you know, just kind of a thing here, definitely just is, like, beyond questionable, to say the least, right? You know, so, essentially, since 2009, what has happened is, since 2009, it's claimed that Netanyahu's, like, political strategy, essentially, is to keep Hamas alive and kicking, even if it hurts his own people. And so the reality of it is that it's just about keeping a conflict alive. And so in order to do that, both sides have to be funded in some way, shape, or form. And one side can't be taking one major, you know, advantage over the other kind of a thing, right? There has to be some kind of balance in this, we'll say, dialectic agenda, right? So, the difference here, though, like, between Islamic Jihad and Hamas, at this point, it really doesn't matter much, because as far as the state of Israel is concerned, the territory is under control of Hamas and is responsible for all the training and activities there. And while initially opposing the Israeli government through guerrilla warfare tactics, Fatah began pursuing more diplomatic avenues of engagement in the 1980s that ultimately led to the Oslo Accords and the proposal of a two-state solution. So, unlike Hamas, Fatah recognizes Israel and wants to build a two-state solution along the borders established after the 1967 Six-Day War. And this would define the Gaza Strip, West Bank, and East Jerusalem as Palestine. So, what happens here is Fatah is a reverse acronym of the Arabic translation of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement. Fatah is the biggest secular Palestinian political party and the driving force behind the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, and the Palestinian Authority. Party was formed in 1959 by Palestinian diaspora activists, including former President Yasser Arafat and current President Mahmoud Abbas, just over a decade after the 1948 Arab-Israeli War, which displaced about 750,000 Palestinians with the creation of Israel, referred to as the Nakba or catastrophe in Arabic. So Fatah currently only controls the West Bank, having been forced out of Gaza by Hamas in 2007, a year after Hamas unexpectedly won legislative elections that were followed by violent clashes between two parties. All I have to say is that people are selected and not elected, so be careful what it is you are reading. Don't take everything at face value. So, Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, was an umbrella organization created in 64 and consists of several political parties. PLO represents the Palestinian people at the UN and in various multilateral institutions. Although Fatah members maintain a majority in the organization, the PLO also includes other parties such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, its offshoot Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and the Palestinian People's Party. Militant groups such as Hamas and Palestinian Jihad are not part of the PLO and oppose its close relationship with Palestinian Authority, which works with Israeli officials to maintain security in the West Bank. Although the Palestinian Liberation Army is technically the PLO's military branch, the PLA operations are run by host governments, not the PLO. So currently the only nation actively hosting PLA forces is Syria, which has a long history of supporting militant Islamist objectives. So basically you have a mix of organizations that essentially, and I'm talking only at face value here, right? It doesn't really matter what the surface values are of a particular organization or what it is you're reading. These things can change in the blink of an eye. But for the, we'll say, theater role, if you will, you have certain groups in Palestine that oppose a two-state solution with Israel and Palestine, and then you have groups that want to maintain a two-state solution of sorts. So that's kind of the difference there in terms of some of the organizations that are out there. So here, now I'm going to go through this video here a little bit. And so what I want to say is this particular channel, Rome Rules, I would suggest people check out, as I've learned quite a bit about the Jesuits through there, and I've learned quite a bit about the Al-Thani family through there, as I'm going to be talking about with this particular video I'm going through. It says the Vatican's U.S. government stipulated the terms of the recent ceasefire and hostage exchange of November 24th, 2023 between Israel and Hamas, and compelled both combatants, in the case of Hamas via Qatar, to accept terms of the deal. And then now moving towards 16 seconds, Qatar's foreign ministry negotiated with Hamas about the hostage release and ceasefire engagement on behalf of Papal America. I like the way that was placed there, because, you know, the most top officials typically I find are part of the Jesuit order, otherwise known as the Society of Jesus, or part of the Knights of Malta. So it's interesting to note that the Qatari government first approached the Jesuit Biden White House about its ability to potentially secure the release of hostages, according to the Associated Press. The most senior officials are living discreetly in Qatar. Absolutely. So while the U.S. takes the face of these negotiations, if you will, the Hamas officials that are used are generally part of the Al-Thani family, and you can see them kind of working to control both sides of the narrative. So this particular individual is the Prime Minister and Foreign Affairs Minister of Qatar, and he's also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he spoke at the Georgetown University in Qatar in 2019 about Qatar's foreign policy, affairs, and objectives. And so with the Georgetown Advisory Board, with the Qatar Georgetown University Advisory Board, excuse me, you can essentially see a lot of different members and stuff like that that are all part of the Al-Thani family, right? And so here, with this advisory board, you can see the appointed individuals. You have one particular woman here, the Al-Thani, who's the co-chair, and then also through and throughout, you'll see I'll leave links in the description, and also those things will be stated in this video if you want to take 4.5 minutes to watch the entirety of the thing. So, as shown in 2019, there were 12 members of Qatar's Foreign Affairs Ministry that were graduates of Jesuit Georgetown University in Qatar. So, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman bin Jassim Al Thani's executive administration and foreign ministry make the Qatari government another Jesuit collaborationist state in the Middle East. Prime Minister, Foreign Minister, and other cabinet officials are decreed into office by the monarch, the Emir of Qatar, currently Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani, who is regarded by the Royal Islamic Strategic Studies Center as the most influential Muslim in the world in 2022. Multiple members of the Al Thani royal family serve on advisory boards at Qatar Georgetown University, like I've said. So, 28 to 232. Yep, this I've already shown you. And then 239, you have this particular guy who resides in Qatar, and like I had said, a lot of the senior members of Hamas actually discreetly live in Qatar. And he's essentially the former chief of Hamas's political bureau and current leader of Hamas's diaspora office. And as well, Michel had significant correspondence with Jesuit Raymond Helmick in the early 2000s. So this is to show his Jesuit affiliations as well. One meeting saw Michel and other members of Hamas's political bureau speaking with the Jesuit for hours, lasting until 3 o'clock a.m. And as indicated by Haaretz, which I think is a magazine or newspaper of sorts in Israel, the ceasefire and hostage negotiations required dealing with Hamas's Qatari proxy leadership, including Michel, who I was just talking about. And also it says here that 13 Israeli hostages were released so far during the ceasefire, and Israel has also released hostages and has agreed to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza during the ceasefire. I'm not exactly sure how current that particular piece of information is, if I'm honest. And so, of course, here you could see that this is all just another Jesuit papacy controls the Israel-Palestine dialectic, and also Jesuit Pope Francis had accused both sides of terrorism just one day before the ceasefire. So be on the lookout for more moves by the Jesuit-aligned Qataris to work with Papal America to broker a more long-term peace accord, possibly with stipulations involving the old city of Jerusalem, which was supposedly at the source of the agitation which promoted the attack from Hamas on October 7th. So, now, this other Al Thani guy here, in particular, the reason why I bring up Sheikh Khalifa ibn Hamad Al Thani is because this particular guy is one who founded Al Jazeera, which is a popular news outlet in the Middle East. And while there were certain American outlets not allowing for the quote-unquote Osama bin Laden footage, Al Jazeera was allowing that, although that is just part of the theater. But that is what Al Jazeera, to me, is famously known for. So, anyway, now I'm going to move forward here because I think I've spoken about both sides of the conflict enough. But in particular, in this particular reel, which I'll be linking, you have this particular instigator here named Lily that has attacked me in particular in my videos. And we've seen that she has supported Russia, Pat King, and is now on the side of the Palestine protesters. And of course, when somebody goes up and says hi to her, she of course lifts a mask over her face, which is just kind of ironic considering, you know, being part of the freedom movement. So, biology and engineering, this is what creates the term bioconvergence, and this is what Israel Innovation uses as terminology, and Policy Horizons in Canada uses the term biodigital convergence. And so I actually, once again, want to thank James Scott for bringing this all to my attention. This is somebody who knows a whole lot more about technology and biology and what these organizations are doing than I do. But the key piece to take away from this is that the bioconvergence, biodigital convergence, whatever you want to call it, the amalgamation of biological life and AI, this is exactly how organizations like the United Nations and stuff like that fulfill their goals of controlling or reducing what they call carbon-based life, right, which is pretty much everything. So, it says here, the field of bioconvergence could potentially become one of Israeli high-tech industry's most substantial engines of growth. The Israel Innovation Authority is working in collaboration with additional entities to expand its operations in order to see competitive ecosystem to advance this field in Israel. And in recent years, global health and medicine have been undergoing a revolution driven by two main factors. First, the global health systems and biopharm industry crisis caused by a large increase in health expenditures and in the development costs of new medicines. The second factor relates to recent technological breakthroughs in the field of engineering, biology, and medicine. Revolution is fostering a new multidisciplinary industry that is based on the synergy between different technologies from fields of biology and engineering, known as quote-unquote bioconvergence. So, again, the quote-unquote scandemic, if you will, really is like an opportunity for these people to develop their technology and that kind of a thing and even forward their agenda. And the other fact of the matter that I want to say is that, and even I'm guilty of this, but narrowly focusing on stuff like digital ID or, you know, certain coercive procedures having taken place that we were told were for protecting us and for the sake of our health, if you will. These, and again, sorry for the language I'm using, I just want this video to stay on YouTube, but the thing is, all of these things are just narrow, small pieces of the whole biodigital convergence or bioconvergence thing, and so anybody who is either narrowly focusing on these things either has more to learn, like I had more to learn at one point, and still am doing so, or they're simply gatekeeping. So take your pick. But anyway, technological breakthroughs and a combination of innovative genetic and digital technologies can assist in identifying and contending with the complexities inherent in chronic diseases. Furthermore, they help identify the dormant stage of these diseases to preempt outbreak of symptoms. Accordingly, health systems continue to make the transition from a model whereby success is measured by the number of patients being treated, volume-based model, to a model that measures success by the quality and efficiency of the treatment, value-based model. And that is also expressed by the ability to avoid medical treatments. The transition necessary for both governments and service providers and by the patients themselves is driving the need for technological innovation that can meet the new challenges and needs of the health system. So here we can see that basically technological breakthroughs achieved in recent years enable to connect and combine fields in a way that was previously impossible. The genomic revolution, the dramatic decline in the cost and increased speed of DNA sequencing alongside artificial intelligence and big data are today leading to the development of advanced diagnostic technologies. They're based on protein level, genomic, and clinical data. Alright, if you say so here. And there's two other fields essentially of, there's two other fields developing alongside biotechnology that are, how do I put it, that are of gene therapy, which is at the cutting edge of personalized healthcare, and synthetic biology that is based on a combination of innovative technologies such as DNA sequencing, creation and writing of new genes, among others, by using CRISPR technology, behavioral modeling of specific genes, and precise measurement of gene behavior. So, apart from engineering, I'll go up and look at that diagram in a sec, but apart from engineering, the Innovation Authority has witnessed other multidisciplinary combinations that are based on engineering technological breakthroughs. These technologies include, for example, miniaturization of electronic components combined with tissues and engineered living materials, smart biosensors, communications, and 3D printing of tissues. All these constitute the foundation of the technological innovation engine termed bioconvergence. So, moving toward the quote-unquote 21st century here, so you can kind of see a sort of comparison between biotechnology and software and engineering. So chemical drugs and data, biological drugs and computing, digitization of biological data, artificial intelligence and big data, and then you have material science and genetic therapy. So, and these are both different kinds of technological development of sorts, and so eventually these two kinds of tech developments meet in the middle, if you will, and that's where you have the synthesis of AI, digitalization, and that synchronized with biology and human anatomy. So you have this particular guy who's the CEO of Israel Innovation Authority, Dror Bin. He's an independent public entity that operates for the benefit of the Israel innovation ecosystem and Israeli economy as a whole. Its role is to nurture and develop Israeli innovation sources while creating and strengthening the infrastructure and framework needed to support the entire knowledge industry. So, and as well, you can read about his background yourself, but he's got a background in telecommunications and big tech and that sort of a thing. He doesn't necessarily sound as quote-unquote scary as Crystal van der Elst, which is the CEO of Policy Horizons Canada, CEO of Global Foresight Group, and former member of a certain department within the World Economic Forum. So the one thing a lot of people are quiet about is the biodigital convergence and how this actually works, because there are, again, several little tiny aspects. Like I said, digital ID or, you know, the quote-unquote coercive health measures, if you will, were, you know, another one small part of it. And the other part of it is Web3 governance, blockchain, and digital ID. So Owen Swiderski, there's a reason why I'm mentioning you, and I will get to it. So this particular guy was around in the truck convoy, paired with Freedom George, whose name is actually Tyson Billings, and as well Pat King. And he is a former candidate for the Green Party in Battleford, Saskatchewan, and in North Battleford, excuse me. And he was involved in the truckers' protest, like I was saying. He has a page entitled The Great Rebellion on Facebook, and as well, he has a Rumble channel. And so you could see here that he was identified as one of the co-leaders of the cryptocurrency effort called Freedom Convoy Token, or FCT. And so the GoFundMe crowdfunding page was taken down. And so I'm not sure exactly if these particular funds were seized or not, but the reality is that crypto funds were seized during the truck convoy, and the fact of the matter is this allows organizations like JP Morgan and other big banks and financial institutions and investment firms to work with their Web3 governance tools. And the blockchain in and of itself, which people who follow QAnon or whatever, other psyops, would refer to this as the quantum financial system. And so part of the Great Awakening, if you will, it involves what they call Nisara Jisara, return to gold-backed currency and that kind of a thing. But what it really is gold-backed NFTs, non-fungible tokens, right? Which are just pictures, if you will, of gold tokens on the blockchain. And so the Great Awakening and the Great Reset are like red and blue politics. They really work for the same people and have the same agenda. And so with this video here that I watched, you know, there were some elements of misinformation that had to do with kind of overtly supporting Palestine, even though the narrative is controlled on both sides, like I was saying. And also, too, I don't hear any sort of talk about the bio-digital convergence from Owen Swiderski. And lastly, as well, one of the staged incidents that I had covered in a prior video that had shown, you know, Stand for Thee, quote-unquote, interrupting a... I shouldn't say Stand for Thee, it was really this guy named V and Jane Sharp in particular that attended one of the Save the Children convoy events and were chanting Trudeau for treason over and over and interrupted them. And once V had gotten into a car that had no front bumper on it, somebody jumped on top of the car and was supposedly punching the windshield and left a dent. And if you even look at that, that doesn't even make sense with how hard it is to dent a windshield, being that you have glass, sheet of plastic in between, and then another glass piece, sort of like a sandwich, if you will, that, you know, crowbars and stuff bounce off of that. And also that car had no front bumper. But if you watch Owen's video here, that car is completely pixelated, right? So I don't know exactly. The thing is, he does call out the Save the Children convoy to some extent and even talk about the constitutional sheriffs and relating things to Marcus Ray. However, he didn't really talk about how Vets for Freedom's plan was actually, you know, a revelation of the method instead of an actual leak. So I think that there are some aspects that could possibly be cleared up. So the reason why I'm bringing all this up, so Owen, you can feel free to reach out to me directly either through the comments on my YouTube channel or you can find me on Facebook at Matt Unseated. And that goes for anybody who's watching. So thanks for watching, everyone, and take care of yourselves.